What's up, everyone, and welcome to the seventh episode of Shooting the Breeze. I'm your host, Max Hooper, and the purpose of this podcast is for me to share my unique basketball experiences and perspectives while also sharing those of my guests. For those of you who aren't aware, my entire senior season at Elkhorn University, I did not attempt one two-point field goal, and I took a whole lot of threes, 257 of them, as a matter of fact. I've always prided myself in being a great shooter, and that is what continues to propel my basketball career. So, yep, you guessed it. On this show, we'll be talking shooting. Today, I have a very special guest, the head coach of Brewster Academy, Jason Smith. I played for Coach Smith at Brewster Academy for 1 year during my postgraduate year of high school. He's currently in his 17th year as the head coach at Brewster. His teams consistently send 10 or more players to the Division I level on scholarship, while Brewster has also had 10 NBA players since Coach Smith began coaching. He recruited me to Brewster, and I'm incredibly thankful that he did. Although I was only there for 1 year, I'm incredibly thankful for the experience that I had while I was at Brewster. Today, Coach Smith and I will talk about how he assembles his teams, the daily life of the student athlete in prep school, the college recruiting process, and much more. Without any further ado, what's up, Coach Smith? Great to have you on the show.
My pleasure, Max. Great to be with you.
Absolutely, absolutely. So let's rewind a little bit and let's talk about, you know, Brewster Academy. You know, since the dawn of time, it has, every year there hasn't been just 10 D1 players who have always just shown up at Brewster Academy. Talk about, how did this get started? Where, and did you envision it becoming what it is today once you first got rolling up at Wolfboro?
Yeah, I started at Brewster in the fall of 2000. I was hired in the late spring of 2000. And at that point in time, the former head of school, Mr. David Smith, told me that he wanted to market the school and build Brewster's brand and reputation by having a successful basketball program. And at that time, they were competing in what was NEPSAC Class B, which was the second highest classification at that point in time. Mm-hmm. And what he wanted to do, and our vision was to have a competitive basketball program, but by no means to the point where we've gotten now. I mean, on our first team, we had a handful of guys that went on to play at the collegiate level as well, including at the Division I level. My very first recruit was a kid from Massachusetts named Mike Smiley, who earned a scholarship to Holy Cross. Then I got a kid from Canada who was 5'9" in the program, but probably closer to about 5'7", mm-hmm. who went to American University as a walk-on and ultimately earned a scholarship his junior and senior year. And then one other young man who went on to play at Cornell University, King Ogbagu, who is now a physician in Ohio.
Got it. So it hasn't always been, I guess, what it's been, and I don't know. I guess it just grew that way as you continue to get better and better players. Would you say?
Yeah, I think that every year we continue to attract more and more interest, and when you attract, when you have more candidates and potential students in the funnel, obviously you're going to get some players that are at a higher level. But at the same time, you didn't want to have to sacrifice academics or integrity or character. So I think every year, you know, the amount of inquiry started to grow to the point where now we're receiving about 800, 900 inquiries a year from kids that are interested in pursuing and applying to Brewster.
Wow. I think when I was coming into school, that number was around, you might have said 400 or 500. So I mean, I guess it just shows, you know, the growth. And I mean, it's natural, you know, when kids see something good and see something that's, you know, appealing, attractive, putting out D1 players year in and year out, it sort of ends up recruiting itself at this point, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. Our best recruiters are always our current and former players. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that are recommending kids that they know to look at Brewster and for us to really evaluate.
Okay, so you kind of brought it up nicely. I wanted to go into the recruiting process, and I think it's kind of unique for you because essentially you're having to recruit a whole new team every year, you know, with a few exceptions here or there, handful of guys who stay 2 to 3 years, but you know, the majority is it's a whole new team every year. So what is the Do you have like a blueprint in your mind in terms of what type of players you might need or building blocks or what's your mindset going into having to find a whole new team?
Yeah, it's probably the aspect of my job that I enjoy the most. You know, as somebody that studied sport management in college, mm-hmm. you know, I like putting together teams and having different pieces, you know, kind of like a general manager.
Sure.
And the one thing that I always, you know, evaluate first and foremost is character and guys that want to be part of a winning program where winning is the ultimate thing. And I'll try to find guys that, not in a negative way, but have a little bit of a chip on their shoulder and that they feel as though, for whatever reason, they were overlooked prior to coming to Brewster, but if they have the opportunity to come to Brewster, they're going to take advantage of all the exposure and opportunities that it would provide.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, that makes sense. I think from, you know, from an external perspective, a lot of people might be like, well, he's got all these players, you know, all these ranked players, all these highly recruited players. How do they buy in? You know, how are there never, you know, major, you know, attitude issues or selfishness issues? And I can speak from my perspective. I think a lot of it has to do with the tradition and the culture, you know what I mean? The majority of the guys on, you know, that are coming to Brewster were dominant high school players, obviously, you know, probably if not the best on their high school team, one of the best players and used to having the ball in their hands. And those guys might come to Brewster and average only 6 points or, you know, might only play 15 minutes a game rather than the whole game. And I think it takes a kid who's willing to buy in, but also have that level of talent. Would you agree?
Yeah, again, I think one of the first things that we'll tell kids, and I always really appreciate the kids that come to a place like Brewster for, you know, their junior or even their senior year, because they sacrifice so much in doing so because they see the big picture. They understand that when they go to college, you know, they're not going to be high volume shooters. So I always, you know, point blank ask guys like, hey, if you're interested in, you know, taking 25 shots a game and reading your name in the paper every night and, you know, having people tell you how great you are and being the hometown hero, then you probably should not pursue a place like Brewster. But if you want to continue to be challenged every single day and compete and win, then it's something that you should seriously investigate. But it, you know, each kid is different. You know, kids like Deontay Burton, who you played with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Deontay Burton was a, you know, consensus top 100 player when he was a freshman, and he left home to come to Brewster for his senior year to play with a bunch of you guys who were significantly older. And I remember at the end of the year, Deontay saying like, hey, this is one of the best decisions I made, because mm-hmm. I didn't like sitting on the bench, but he understood why he was sitting on the bench and really understood how to play a little bit as the year progressed.
Right. I think you said senior on accident. Just to be clear, I think you meant sophomore when he was much younger and playing behind a bunch of
guys. Yeah, playing behind a bunch of guys that were seniors or even post-grads. He was a true sophomore.
Exactly. So we've kind of touched on it a little bit, but is there, like you said, you target that mindset, that mentality, that character. But what about if there's a kid who's so incredibly talented? Are you willing to maybe take a sacrifice in maybe having a kid who has a few red flags or those sorts of things? Or is that something you'd prefer to steer clear of?
Definitely steer clear of. And again, Brewster rooster, when you actually have to go through the application process. You know, there are a lot of times kids that contact me that want to come to Rooster, and I say, yeah, you got to get, you know, fill out the application. Obviously, you got to submit transcripts and testing, but you also, probably the most important part of the process, obviously for admission, but also for myself as a coach, are the recommendations from your current teachers. And the reason why that's so important is your teachers are the ones who spend every single day with you. They're going to let us know the true person that you are, your work ethic, your character, your relationships with your peers, your honesty, your integrity. And those are things that are ultimately the most important when you're talking about the success of the team. So I put the recommendations from the teachers, you know, you have to submit three recommendations, and the recommendations are all very detailed. It's about 20 different categories, and they ask the teacher to evaluate a student in those, you know, 20 different areas, and 1 through 5, with 5 being the highest. You know, so a perfect recommendation score from 3 recommendations is 15. That means you're excellent in all areas. You know, so what I do is I look at the 3 recommendations and I average each recommendation. So your one recommendation may be a 4.2, one might be a 3.2, and one might be a 2.7. You add those 3 recommendation scores up, I will not consider anyone who is below a 12.
And that's, go ahead.
And that's completely a system that I've used over the last probably 7 or 8 years.
Right. And that's a fair way of evaluating, like, just the type of kid he is. Because I think the way a kid conducts him, in the high school class, you know, is he respectful to the teacher, those sorts of things. I mean, I think you'd probably agree, directly correlates to how is he going to, you know, operate within a team, and how is he going to be around campus and all sorts of things like that. Like,
yeah, especially in a boarding school situation where, you know, you are accountable. There is a lot of structure in place.
Totally. And, you know, I think what the casual, now that I went to boarding school and I'm so familiar with it, like the casual person who maybe isn't as familiar with, you know, prep school and is maybe not from the, you know, New England area, I think they just might think of prep school teams as, oh, just, you know, a bunch of guys thrown together and, you know, they're not really going to class, you know. I think there's a certain stigma that can kind of, I don't know why it comes about, but, you know, undeservingly, but it just, for some reason, people outside of the area might not be as aware of what exactly goes on in the NEPSAC. Why do you think that is?
I think it's just ignorance. You know, they assume that they just see, you know, highlight clips on YouTube and, you know, and following AAU or grassroots basketball, they think that teams are just thrown together, and not understanding that, as you can attest to, the day at boarding school, or Brewster in particular, is pretty structured. You know, from the time you wake up to the time you go to bed at night, your day is essentially mapped out for you. And I think that's why you see college coaches, you know, trying to recruit kids from high-end prep programs where they know that structure is in place. So when they get a kid that comes from a Brewster or another, you know, high-level NEPSAC program, that kid has already been away from home. He's already had to, you know, live and have some independence, but also be in a very structured environment.
Right. It's almost like a college environment, you know, without the pressures of the college environment, whether it's from, you know, pressure from, you know, a coach who's dependent on you to feed his family by keeping his job, or, you know, classes are much harder, obviously, or just the social pressure, all sorts of things, you know. It's just a mini college experience of sorts. But then there's another aspect to it, and I even went through this because I did so well in high school and excelled academically, and I'm looking at it like, as I'm considering, you know, should I go to college, should I go to Brewster Academy, etc. why am I doing another year of high school if I did so well? You know, a lot of kids might run into that as being high academic kids, but who might benefit from a fifth year at a high level prep program. How do you address that with a kid?
Yeah, unless a kid has taken, you know, my favorite is when I ask a kid, you know, what they've done for math, and they say, oh, I'm all done with math.
Right.
I say, okay, so you've gotten through AP Calculus BC. You have a 800 on your math SAT score. And they look at me like, no, I got a 520. Okay, then you haven't mastered, you're not done math. Because obviously you have some work to do to continue to improve. And I deal with it every week from a kid that contacts me and is interested in Brewster. They always say, hey, well, I'm interested in playing on your prep basketball team. And I say, well, it's an amazing concept, but we actually have classes and you have to take a full course load. So you're going to have at least four, sometimes in most cases, five classes. And a kid that's looking at these places that pop up in the middle of the night set, and they say, well, this so-and-so school said, you only have to take one class. And my response is, well, how are you being challenged? How are you continuing to grow academically by only taking one class?
Mm-hmm.
You know, are you going to go to college and only take one class?
Right. It's not pro basketball. You know, basketball is not the only thing going on here. And, you know, some of these kids, hopefully, you know, one day will be professional basketball players. But ultimately, you know, getting all these kids, the goal is to get scholarships, you know, because you never know when the ball stops bouncing, even, no matter how talented you are, you know. Whether you're at the upper end of the, you know, one of the best players in the NEPSAC, or, you know, one of the guys who's just lucky to be on one of the teams, you know, you have to obviously take advantage of that, and ultimately I think the goal for everyone is to get a scholarship. But the whole academic piece, you know, it sometimes gets lost in the shuffle when people don't have the full perspective on what exactly prep school is. But so let's go back to the basketball a little bit. When you're building a team, go back to the recruiting part. When you're building a team, how important is it for you to get certain pieces who kind of have their own niche carved out on a team? You know, like a guy who, you know, runs the show as the point guard, you know, a dominant big man, a shooter. You know, how important do you think are roles on a team for guys to understand those roles to excel?
It's crucial when you're putting together the team. You know, a lot of times kids don't understand. Each year you progress in your basketball career, mm-hmm. roles become more and more defined.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether you're in most cases, when I get a kid that is coming for a senior year or a post-grad year, their role on their previous team has been, you know, to score, mm-hmm. or to be the main scoring option or the high-volume shooter. And what we try to do is evaluate what other areas of their game are strong, and they may not have been, you know, they may not be aware that, you know, they're a tremendous screener, or they're a great defender, or a great rebounder. But you have to have guys to fill different roles, because, like I said, as you progress up the levels, roles become more and more defined. And when you get to the absolute highest level, the NBA, everybody's a role player except for maybe, you know, 30, 40 players in the NBA total.
Exactly. And I think it's, you know, it's interesting because, like I alluded to earlier, you know, the majority of the kids you've gotten, if a kid's good enough to go to Brewster Academy and he's coming from, you know, a normal high school situation, the kid is probably averaging 20 or 30 points a game, you know, the best player every time he steps out on the court. And, well, at Brewster, there's 10 of those. So not everyone can be the best player. Not everyone can be the ball-dominant guy. And then I think that's kind of a rude awakening for kids sometimes. And then that awakening gets even ruder when they show up at college and they were taking 20 shots a game in high school, and you show up and your role is play defense. Your role is rebound. Well, what about shooting? We don't need you to shoot. We already have our guys who shoot the ball. So it's like, I think that's the awesome thing about prep school is you get that taste of not being the only guy who shoots the ball or being able to take whatever horrible shot is that you want without repercussions, without getting taken out of the game or reprimanded in any way. So I think that's all just, you know, it's interesting, and the kids who don't go through it, I don't think they really understand what they're getting themselves into beforehand.
How many kids that come to a place like Brewster every year do you think have not started a game their previous year in their high school team or in their career?
I mean, if they're at Brewster, they've probably started every game of their high school, probably.
And the very first thing we do is we sit down and we go over the list of guys who did not start during their time at Brewster,
right,
but then talk about how their careers started. Because, like, initially, if you tell a kid, hey, you're coming off the bench, they think, like, okay, my life is over. I'm not starting anymore. How am I going to go play in college? And I'm like, okay, well, T.J. Warren came off the bench for us, played in the McDonald's All-American game,
right,
was the ACC Player of the Year, and a lottery pick.
Right.
I think it turned out okay for him.
I think it turned out okay. And, yeah, I mean, stuff like that, you know, kids, I think the kids just don't have the perspective. But I think they learn pretty quickly. And for some reason, I think it's because, you know, you target the whole character thing. But for some reason, it feels like all your teams have that buy-in. And every team at the beginning of the year, you go, we want to be the first team to go undefeated. You know, we want to win a championship. Like, there's such pride, I think, in the teams. And if that issue, you know, rears its head a little bit in the beginning, I think it's pretty much gone. Not that every team is perfect. Not that every team doesn't have its issues. But I think guys buy in pretty quickly. And I think that process is even accelerated when you have a guy who's, you know, returning from the year before. For example, I was there with Jakar Sampson. And then the next year, you know, him, Jakar and Mitch McGarry both come back. And I think that team, the year after I was there, and you can speak on this as well, but I think that team really had good leadership and good, you know, good direction, in the sense that those guys knew that they knew what to expect and help the guys coming in. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Anytime you have a returner from the year before, they help, you know, kind of lay the groundwork to the current team, you know, not just the day-to-day basketball stuff, but the day-to-day structure of the school, you know, mm-hmm. talking about the recognition system and earning privileges and being on time to commitments and making sure that you're where you're supposed to be at a certain time.
Absolutely. So now, we haven't talked about it yet, but, you know, I titled my podcast Shooting the Breeze, and I'm Max Hooper hosting it, so we got to get into some shooting discussion a little bit. Give me, if you're assessing a high school player as a shooter, you know, what would three major keys that you would look for in a player? What makes a great shooter? What would three keys be from your perspective?
Confidence. Mm-hmm. You know, shooter's going to have a very short memory. You know, their next shot is going in. I think that's probably first and foremost. You know, they have to have a consistent release point. The release point has to be the same at all times. And I would say they have to have a quick release. I've seen kids that, you know, were touted as shooters at the high school level that when they got to our level or the collegiate level, it didn't translate because their release was too slow. Mm-hmm. They weren't able to get their shot off against guys with some size and athleticism. But I think confidence is probably first and foremost what I look for in a shooter.
Right. Like, I don't, like, if you're going to, let's say you're, you know, going to assess a kid who's thinking about coming to Brewster Academy and supposed to be this great high school shooter, and the kid comes out and shoots the ball four times, I don't think that you can really, you know, categorize him as a shooter. You know what I mean? It has to be a guy who, you know, has no conscience, a reckless abandon, you know, and is willing to miss the shots, you know?
Yep.
And I think that's, and what you talked about, you know, being able to get your shot off a quick enough release, because at the NEPSAC and then obviously even more so in college, you know, the scouting report is so huge, you know. If a guy's tagged as a shooter, they're not just going to get open looks. This is not low-level high school basketball where they just sit in a 2-3 zone and you can take your time and tee it up. Anyone can tee it up and make the shots. But can you make the shots with, you know, a 6'6 athlete breathing down your neck and while you're sprinting off screen? So I think that's, you know, so important to be able – you have to get your shot off. Otherwise, a shooter is pretty much neutralized. So
yeah, and knowing how to move without the ball to get open as a shooter. As you go up the levels, as you said, the scouting reports become more and more intense and detailed.
Totally. So, obviously, I'm biased, but you know, I think shooting has a huge, major impact on a team, on any player, really, to you know, create space on the court. What are some thoughts you have? What is the overall impact that shooting might have on a team, or a specific shooter would have on a team?
Yeah, I think that a really good shooter or multiple shooters on the floor. Driving lanes for point guards, you know, you can't help off of a shooter to shrink the floor. It opens up, you know, the ability for a strong post player to throw the ball inside, because again, if you throw it into the block and you have a shooter on that same side of the floor, you can't double down into the post. So I think that having one shooter or even multiple shooters on the floor, you know, makes everybody around them so much more dangerous.
Totally. Obviously, I agree. You know, because I think what I bring to the table is great, and I think one of my Oakland teammates actually suggested this to me on the podcast before. He said, every shot that a shooter creates, he said that he thinks the shooter should get an assist. You know, he's kind of joking, but I think it makes sense. You know, like I feel like there's a lot of times where I wouldn't even touch the ball, and I'd run off a screen of some sort, and I get the other player wide open looks. I think it's just funny, you know, how much attention a shooter attracts, because in college, at least, when I feel like sometimes when I would bury a shot, I'd look over at the bench and, you know, the assistant coach is slamming his clipboard, you know, and I can just imagine them yelling, "We talked about this all week," you know, those sorts of things. It's just funny, and the impact of shooting is just so. It's such a big thing, because it's, number one, it's worth more points, and it's a momentum swinger, would you say?
Oh, absolutely. And again, if you think about some of the guards that you played with, even your year at Brewster, I think Nadir was he was able to obviously locate you on the perimeter, but at the same time when he had the ball, driving lanes were so wide because people could not help off of you. So, you know, guys like you are part of the reason why he was the player of the year, because he looked so special with his decision making and ability to get to the rim.
Totally. And I think, yeah, I really like that, because I think that also goes back to, you know, talking about what we talked about with roles. If everyone knows their role and everyone wants to excel in their role, then I think, you know, the shooter helps the scoring big man, and then the scoring big man helps the shooter, and the point guard helps the shooter. You know, I think that, and then you put it all together, and I think that builds, you know, a special team when you have guys who are accepting of their role and want to excel in their role and understand what their role is and what they bring to the table. So, you've had a lot of great players at Brewster Academy, a lot of different guys. I don't even know what the number is at now, but countless D1 players. And I think to date, the number is 9 NBA players. Is that accurate? Has it been 9?
It's actually 10.
10, my bad. So 10 NBA players. When these kids first stepped on campus, could you have handpicked the ones who would be NBA players and who wouldn't? Could you have identified that a kid was head and shoulders that much, you know, beyond everyone else?
In a couple instances, yes. Like Will Barton, in my opinion, was an NBA player just in terms of his ability to just score the ball. It was just effortless. You know, right. T.J. Warren was as gifted as a scorer as we've ever had as well, but he obviously needed to to improve different areas of his game. But, you know, I think the reason why some of those guys have made the NBA or did make the NBA is because they embraced their role and understood, in order for me to make it to the highest level, I have to do something in the top one percentile, be better than everybody else. You know, guys like Jeff Adrian, who is a 6'7" power forward, he just played so hard and so physical and was just a tremendous rebounder. Thomas Robinson, the same thing. They just made it to that level based on work ethic and playing hard every single possession. And guys don't like the offensive rebound, but if you look at the guys that are, you know, the best offensive rebounders or best rebounders in the NBA, they get paid pretty well for that niche.
Totally, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to lump out all the NBA players into, you know, from Brewster into one category, because they're all different guys, they all have their own journey, but I just think there's such a gray, you know, a gray area, and it's not black and white. Is this kid an NBA player? Is this kid, you know, not an NBA player? And there's so many good players out there, you know, there's so many guys in the D-League or overseas right now who could be playing in the NBA and contributing. But I think a lot of it comes down, you know, being in the right situation and kind of being lucky, frankly. But I just think there's so many kids who come through your program, and you never really know who is going to end up being the one who, you know, gets to the NBA, because I think kids have a certain level of talent. And then I think another big factor in, you know, who gets to that level is who picks the right college, who goes to a school where they can showcase themselves. Would you agree?
Absolutely, it's you know, it's having the fitting the into the right style of play. You know, we've been pretty fortunate in that a lot of the guys, namely the guys that are in the NBA, when we first evaluated them, they weren't necessarily household names. You know, sure, Will Barton certainly was, but you know, Jeff Adrian, when he was a high school senior, his only Division I offer was Wright State.
Wow, I didn't even know that, actually.
People get caught up, he's a 6'7" power forward, but he's got ridiculously long arms, so it allowed him to play a lot bigger. Thomas Robinson, when he had contacted us during his high school season, his only offer was George Washington.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Coach Lee and I, myself, are looking at him like, yeah, this kid looks pretty good. He's probably somebody worth taking. You know, he's humble. Nobody really knows about him. He hasn't been, you know, enabled. He doesn't play on a you know, huge sneaker sponsored program. It doesn't have a tremendous ego. He wants to get better. And then the summer before, a lot of times it's the case of the summer before they come to Brewster is when they blow up. But at that point, we've already evaluated them and said, you know, this kid is really good. Samaje Christian was the same thing. I think he had, you know, Akron was the Division I school that had offered him at that point.
Right. Yeah, and I think you've been doing this so long, you can almost be like, yeah, just watch. In the next 2-3 months, this kid is going to be on it, you know, be a household name. And it's almost funny now, because I think sometimes you pointed out to me, you're like, just wait, this kid's going to get like 10 D1 offers in the next month. And it happens, you know, it's funny.
It's part of that evaluation process of not just the player, but their character. Where is their mind at? Are they more focused on, you know, their highlight on YouTube or the amount of followers they have on Instagram, or are they more focused on getting better every single day and improving?
Right. Yeah, definitely. So the next thing I want to ask, I've asked this, you know, I've had. So before I had you on here, I've had only players, and I've gotten the players' perspective on this, and I just want to see what you have to say on this. So a lot of times kids, not always the case, but a lot of times kids, the first school or one of the first few schools who recruits them ends up being the school they should go to. And I say that because if a kid, you know, extends his recruiting process and waits it out, gets to the end of the line. There's a lot of these high major schools who have missed on, you know, their first, second, third, even fourth, fifth options, and boom, they're desperate. They need a guard. They need a big man. They need a shooter, whatever. And, you know, they throw a kid, you know, an olive branch, throw a kid a scholarship late in the game. And it's, you know, it's attractive for the kid because obviously it's flattering to have these big schools come calling, but it might not be a school that, you know, is suited to the kid's style of play or is a place where a kid is going to excel because maybe next year he's going to get recruited right over or he doesn't fit the system. But they're, so what are your thoughts on, you know, kids who choose a school, you know, with a bigger name rather than, you know, maybe a lesser school, a school with less notoriety but would be a better fit for them?
Yeah, I tell kids that where they should go to school is one where they would be happiest just as a traditional student, but mm-hmm. two, and again, kids don't necessarily pay attention to how I say this, but where the head coach invests the most time, because the head coach ultimately is the person that puts guys in the game and mm-hmm. takes them out of the game.
Right.
And all these programs, especially at the highest level, their recruiting budget is enormous. You know, right. How much effort is this head coach putting in to try to land you and get you to come to their school? Are they calling you? Are they texting you? Are they getting on a plane, driving to see you? What are they doing to show you how serious they are? And a lot of times, kids get confused. You know, the assistant coach does all the legwork, and all of a sudden the head coach comes in one time to try to close the deal. And I always tell kids, and it's always, in my opinion, the later you wait, you're going to have more options, but two, it's going to be a clearer picture of what the roster looks like. Like, so much can change from the time you commit in the fall or mm-hmm. the summer from when you actually step foot on campus. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've had instances where kids committed to college programs where the school is probably a 3 or 4 hour drive from our campus mm-hmm. where we never saw that head coach. Right. And I would turn to Coach Lee and say, that kid is not going to make it there. He's going to transfer.
Right.
And he said, why? And I said, and I'll say, well, the head coach can get in the car and be here in 3 hours, and they have yet to do that.
Right.
The head coach is the one that puts the guys in the game, takes them out of the game.
I like that. You know, people didn't phrase it like that, but that's because you have a different perspective. But I think it's, you know, nowadays more than ever, you know, I think the majority of kids, you know, going to Brewster, their goal is to, you know, play after college and be pros and hopefully play in the NBA. But nowadays, if you want to play in the NBA, you got to go to the school that fits you best. You know, some of the best players in the NBA didn't go to the, you know, name brand schools. Damian Lillard, Steph Curry, and then even I've dealt with it on a personal level. Kay Felder went to Oakland University, his only scholarship offer, and chose the right school where he played 30 minutes as a freshman, where he got to play through mistakes, where he was in an up-tempo system that fit his style, and he ended up, you know, ultimately getting drafted. And I just think that the name of a big school, when that school pops up on your radar and starts recruiting, you know, feels good. And I dealt with it. You know, it felt good when St. John started recruiting me and when I had the opportunity to go, you know, play in Madison Square Garden. But I've said this before, and I think you've said something along these lines. You know, Madison Square Garden doesn't look so good from the bench. Madison Square Garden is not so pretty from the bench. And so ultimately I ended up where I was supposed to end up. But, you know, every kid's journey is different, and every kid has to make that decision for themselves, I think.
It's all part of the learning process. I mean, I can't tell you how many guys we've had over the years that went to a school that they thought was the best fit because, you know, it was a sexy name. Mm-hmm. And then a year or two later, they transfer and they call me and they'll say, hey, why didn't you tell me that, you know, that wasn't a good opportunity? My answer is always, you didn't ask.
Right.
Like, if I, to be honest with you, I have no interest in being involved in the recruiting process. It's not anything that, you know, a lot of AAU coaches or high school coaches, they like that attention. I'm the complete opposite. If you have any questions, what I'll do is, because I've been doing this for so long, odds are I've had a kid that played for a certain coach or was recruited from that coach, and I'll just connect the family and say, hey, you know, Max Hooper played for that coach
right.
4 or 5 years ago. Here's his number. Reach out to them. You know, I almost tell kids, like, you should have a relationship. Find out who that 10th man is on the team. Call the 10th man and find out what type of coach or coaching staff they have there, if they're happy. Don't ask the superstar. Don't ask the guy that they put you with when they host you on your official visit.
Right. Don't ask the guy who takes every shot and plays every minute of every game. Ask the guy who might not be quite satisfied with what he's got. I like that. So another thing, I'm going to switch gears a little bit, but another thing that I wanted to address, and it's always out there, you know, whenever people, a lot of people actually ask me, you know, talk to me, because, you know, I went to Modern Day, and I also went to Brewster Academy, which is, you know, two of the premier programs, but in totally different categories, and, you know, people will always be like, oh, you see Modern Day is ranked such and such, and they're like, well, why is Brewster not ranked? Why is Brewster not in those rankings? And why do you think the schools, you know, the Oak Hills, the Modern Days, Finley Prep, Montverde, etc., why do these schools get the national attention that the NEPSAC teams don't? I've always been confused by that myself. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I think that, for example, like the USA Today national rankings, mm-hmm. they don't include schools such as Brewster or programs in the NEPSAC or places like Hargrave Military mm-hmm. because we have 50-year seniors or postgraduates.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's why we're not able to be considered for some of those, you know, rankings.
Mm-hmm. But then there's so many talented players. Why I don't. Like, do you think it's because those teams play games on TV, or there's got to be something more to it just than being included in the ranking, why those teams get all the attention they get, don't you think?
Yeah, and I think that's what makes, you know, the NEPSAC and prep school basketball kind of like the best-kept secret. You know, mm-hmm. the true hoop junkies, the coaches, they know that the premier talent is in the prep school programs.
Mm-hmm.
But the casual basketball
right,
fan,
the YouTube fan or whatever,
yeah, that lives 15, 20 minutes from Brewster has no idea that you can walk in the gym on a given night and see, you know, 15 Division I players on the floor.
Right, right.
they're down at Kingswood cheering their face off for the kid that's going to be playing in the intramural league on Tuesday night.
I hear you. Slight exaggeration there, but I hear you. But yeah, it's kind of a funny concept almost, you know, like this mass of talent just, you know, pretty much, you know, all heads up to New England and in these small schools, you know, you got 70, 80 kids in the graduating class and 10 of them are D1 basketball players and, they all converge on, you know, Lake Winnipesaukee and all that whole area. And maybe there's a gym with, like you said, with 15 D1 players playing in one game and you got 200 people watching it. Or you go up to Bridgeton Academy and there's one row of bleachers, like all sorts of things. You know, it's just, like you said, a hidden gem, I'd say. And it's super interesting for me to think back to how I perceived, you know, that the NEPSAC before I really got exposed to it. And being from California, you know, I'm telling people, oh, I'm going to Brewster Academy, I'm going to a fifth year of high school. Oh, why are you doing that? You know, did you fail your senior year? What happened? You know, did you not get any scholarship offers? No, I got scholarship offers. I had plenty of scholarship offers. I just want to go play at a higher level and go play with the best high school talent in the country for another year before I went to college. And a lot of people just,
right.
for whatever reason, you know, it just doesn't get the attention it get. It, you know, that the, traditional high schools get, but,
Let me ask you, Max, being from California and,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of a topic that's in the basketball community the last few weeks. Chino Hills. Have you seen them play? Have you seen any of the videos or the clips? And what are your thoughts?
Oh, man. I love when my guests ask me questions. That's what I love it. But Chino Hills, I mean, before this, whenever their reign started, I don't know when they first started get, you know, real attention, whether it's the last 2-3 years, whenever Lonzo Ball was there, I'm sure they were good. But I hadn't heard of them till last year. And frankly, I didn't even know that school existed. So it was more, that's more of, I think, just talent converging on that school that'll, and once, you know, once those players cycle out, I don't know if that'll be a tradition type thing. And I think it's different than like a modern day or Brewster or Oak Hill or any of these schools where, you know, the coach has been the mainstay and the coach has been there for, you know, forever and gone through all these players. So Chino Hills, that's a, I mean, they attract attention, you know, also because of their style of play and all those sorts of things.
Well, that's what I mean. What do you think about their style of play as a basketball fan?
I mean, it's controversial. It's controversial for sure. But, I mean, you can't really say much if it wins games, but I don't know if that's the best preparation for kids who want to be high-level college players and hopefully, you know, pros at the end of the day. I don't know if you're being taught or being held accountable for certain things that at a school like Brewster or even modern day that you'd be held accountable for.
Because now modern day just played them right last week.
Yeah, they just beat them. Yeah.
What did you notice anything in the box score of that game?
I noticed that those two kids took what was it 60? I think they went 15 for 67 or something.
Yeah, they one of them missed over 23 pointers.
Mm-hmm. Man, give me 23 pointers. Let's see what I can do.
That's what I'm saying. Now, do you think if you were at Brewster, one, if you took 23 pointers, that would be abnormal.
Oh, 100%.
If you missed 23 pointers, what do you think the reaction would be?
Oh, I mean, it wouldn't have happened. Number one, it wouldn't have happened, but it would just be like the reaction from who? From the coaching and from my teammates?
From coaches, teammates.
I'd be like, what the hell are you doing?
There's a stop level of, shooting. Please.
Yeah, there's a level of accountability and, I mean, it goes back to what we talked about before. You know, it's these kids are used to, I mean, maybe not doing, I don't know if anyone has ever missed 23s in a game on a regular basis, but, you know, the kids are used to doing that and firing the ball up, and they're not used to, you know, setting screens or just playing defense and being ready to shoot the shot when they're even lucky enough to touch the ball. But those are two totally polar opposites, whereas Brewster Academy, I don't know what your stat breakdown this year is, but I'm sure there's a bunch of guys in that 8 points a game, 9 points a game, 10, 11 points a game, rather than two guys averaging 30 and the rest, you know, is that accurate, would you say?
Yeah, we always have 5 to 7 guys in double figures. Mm-hmm. This year is no exception. We have 6 guys averaging between 11 and 17 or 18 points a game.
Right. That's what I didn't know the exact breakdown. But you some people might perceive that as, well, this kid's only averaging 11 points a game, but this kid is at a school where he shoots every ball and he's averaging 28 points a game. And I don't know, maybe is scoring 11 points a game not sexy and that's why the NEPSAC doesn't get the attention and Chino Hill scores 140 and that's sexy? I don't know. But I didn't want to, you know, call out Chino Hills or anything like that, but I just I'd say those are two polar opposites, you know? Totally.
Yeah, I was just wondering your opinion from a basketball fan perspective and somebody that is in California right now, because people out on the East Coast and specifically in the NEPSAC, you know, players, and obviously when you ask the players, like, hey, how do you think we would do against Chino Hills? They look at us like, man, we might win by 50 or 60.
Right.
Just, you know, but kids say that every single game. They see, you know, on YouTube or on ESPN, but also from asking, you know, different coaches, you know, the constant feedback that I receive is like, you're not really preparing that kid who has a bright future and is extremely talented, both of them. You know, how are you preparing them for their next step in their journey to play at UCLA unless Coach Alford's going to have a complete change of philosophy?
Right. Well, and I mean, and then I think then a lot of people, their rebuttal to that is, well, it worked out for the big brother so far. But I think that kid is special. You know what I mean? That kid is on, I think he's on another planet in terms of just talent-wise. Don't you think?
Oh, his size as a point or a lead guard is 6'6". I think he's guaranteed to be a top three selection in the draft. And, you know, people that pick on his game and, you know, talk about his mechanics as a shot, you know, I think that, you know, he makes enough shots with, you know, that unorthodox style to keep people honest.
Right. I mean, yeah, that kid is special. And I mean, his athleticism, the dynamic way he plays. I mean, it fits perfectly into the, you know, the NBA style of today. But we kind of got a little sidetracked there. But let's rein it back in a little bit. Didn't mean to go on a Chino Hills rant. But anyways, that wraps up the main part of what I got for our podcast. But the way, you know, like I said before, my senior year, 257 threes, no 2-pointers. I'm going to keep it with a theme. I like to end all my podcasts with a theme of a top three list. So the top three list that I want to make, and you'll say yours, I'll say mine, we'll go back and forth, is the top three knapsack players in the past, whatever you want to do, 10 to 15 years in recent history, top 10 knapsack players. Top three. Who's your number one that you've got for me?
Isaiah Thomas. Mm-hmm. You know, his success right now with the Celtics, not a surprise to anybody that saw him, that, you know, played against him in the knapsack, coached against him in the knapsack. He was the most difficult player to prepare for when he was at South Kent in the knapsack.
Right.
So he would certainly be one. The second one would probably be Georges Niang, mm-hmm. Just because of his overall versatility, how he really transformed his game, his body, you know, during his, I think he was actually in the knapsack for 5 years. I think mm-hmm. he maybe did grade 9 and then maybe repeated grade mm-hmm. 9 at Tilton School, but just to see his growth from the time he was a, you know, 14 or 15-year-old mm-hmm. freshman, just how hard he worked every single year. You could see that he was going to be a successful college player and now somebody that's, you know, playing in the NBA. Mm-hmm. So those top two, to me, for guys that we competed against in the knapsack are no-brainers. Mm-hmm. Other guys, I mean, we've had so many good players in the knapsack. Andre Drummond was a talented player in the knapsack. It'd be hard to come up with, you know, number three. I think that New Hampton has had guys over the years with Noah Vonleh and Tyler Lydon will certainly, in my opinion, play in the NBA. Tilton had Georges and Nerlens. Mm-hmm. South Kent has had guys go directly from there to the NBA, like Darrell Wright. Mm-hmm. But Georges, Isaiah and Georges, in my opinion, are far and away the top two guys I could come up with.
Got it. Well, I also had my own list that I'll list off in a second. But the reason why I think, number one, you're the perfect person to ask that because you've been around and seen all these players. My list will just be, you know, retrospective on knowing the players that I haven't seen, you know, play live and or in the knapsack themselves. But I like that you base that list on just the way they played when they were in prep school. Because sure, you could say, oh, Drummond is probably Drummond or Isaiah Thomas is probably the biggest, you know, name. But I don't know how Drummond was a dominant force, don't get me wrong, but he's progressed so much since he was in college, in high school. He's progressed so much. And that's how it is for all big men. But my list that I had, I guess one of them isn't technically in the NEPSAC, but Isaiah Thomas, and then I went with the Brewster pick, Will Barton, just because of what Will was able to do, and pretty much, like you said, freak talent-wise, and athleticism, scoring ability, et cetera, et cetera. And then the third guy I went with, someone you actually didn't bring up, but I guess he's technically not in the NEPSAC, but Steven Adams. He was, I mean, obviously he's growing his career right now, but had a, I don't even know how well he did in the prep school, in the whole prep school scene, but obviously was good enough to be one and done, and now is just signed a $100 million extension. So I think he's doing pretty well for himself. And the whole prep school thing worked out nicely for him. But, yeah, that about wraps up all that we've got for this episode. Coach Smith, appreciate you taking the time. It's been a pleasure. Always, you know, can never talk too much basketball and never share too many stories. So really appreciate you taking the time, Coach.
Anytime, Max.
Absolutely. Let's talk soon, and best of luck the rest of this season.
Appreciate it. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.